You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you head out to MacArthur Park these days, sandwiched between downtown and Koreatown, it's packed in the late afternoon.
Hola, buen día.
Shoppers and commuters alike squeeze by one another on the congested, littered sidewalks in the hot sun. You can find just about anything for sale here, on carts, on blankets on the sidewalk, from Salvadoran-style pupusas stuffed with melted cheese to random electronic devices. Think electric razors, phone chargers, portable speakers. There's bustle, sure. But most street vendors here are barely getting by. They've been left out of most government assistance during the pandemic because of their immigration status. Many have fallen ill, and what almost all of them are doing is illegal. Despite years of advocacy to create a permitting system for street vending in Los Angeles, almost no one actually has a permit. Though ticketing is suspended during the pandemic, the rules for street vendors are so complicated and so hard to follow, vendors are subject to fines that they cannot afford. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covers the business of Southern California, and he picks up the story from here.
This street corner by MacArthur Park, 7th and Alvarado, with its four-way crosswalk and overflowing collection of sidewalk vendors, is like a second home to Aureliano Santiago.
Yo empecé a vender aquí en el 92. Llegué en ese país.
I started vending here, he says, in 1992, when I came to this country from La Union in the eastern part of El Salvador.
En aquellos tiempos yo empecé vendiendo hot dog.
In the early days, he says, I sold hot dogs from a cart I bought and then fixed up myself. But like for many vendors in this part of LA, things unraveled for Santiago during the pandemic, and he made the tough choice to pack up his mobile business. Santiago now spends most of his time advocating on behalf of vendors, especially the 70 or so that he says are working right now around MacArthur Park.
Aquí realmente lo que nos está haciendo difícil la vida, que habemos personas que no alcanzamos esa ayuda que dio el gobierno.
Really, what's making life difficult for us, he says, is that we are people who can't access government help. Without that money, it's almost impossible to afford the permits needed to sell legally on the streets of LA. Street vending used to be illegal in many parts of California, including Los Angeles. A state law passed back in 2018 decriminalized street vending, and it allowed local cities and counties to set up a permitting system. But it hasn't gone well in LA. Of the estimated 50,000-plus vendors working in Los Angeles, the city of L.A. says only about 3 to 4% have proper business documents.
I'm sure that number should be much higher, but it's not.
That's David Rivera. He oversees the sidewalk and vending program for the city of L.A. Rivera says the pandemic has hamstrung L.A.'s permitting system. Appointments downtown are limited. And if you want to sell food and not consumer goods like hats or headphones, you've got to deal with the County Department of Public Health and lots more red tape. Not only do food vendors need to secure 2 state permits and pay the roughly $300 a year for a city license, they also need a county health permit. And right now, Rivera says, those are almost impossible to get.
I think the big part of it is you know, kind of, I don't want to blame another, you know, agency or nothing, but you know, the holdup is LA County Health, you know, them not being able to obtain that cart or whatever it is they need from them in order to sell their product.
The price of an annual city permit is also expected to rise to more than $500 soon. Now, LA County's Department of Public Health declined an interview with KCRW, but in a statement, it says it would, quote, continue to provide education and support to those who are interested in learning about the requirements to obtain a health permit, end quote. DPH also says it's issued just under 500 permits for food carts since January of 2019. Health officials have had their hands full in the past year and a half with the pandemic. For folks like Elizabeth Medina, a permit would be nice, but she's going to keep selling whatever she can either way because she just doesn't have another way of making a living.
Tengo que yo trabajar porque yo tengo necesidad, ¿verdad? No me puedo quedar en la casa porque nadie me va a traer el dinero en la cama.
I have to work because I need to, Medina says. I can't stay home because no one is going to bring me money if I'm lying in bed.
Pero también, como todos hemos trabajado, muchos compañeros de nosotros han muerto de COVID.
Also, as we've all worked, she says, many have died of COVID. Medina normally sells avocados on the streets near MacArthur Park. But because of her health, she says, things have become much more difficult. Medina is struggling with some of the long-term effects of COVID-19. She's in and out of doctor's appointments, has trouble breathing, and just can't seem to get better. She also has a family and children that rely on what she brings home. And since she's been back at work, it hasn't been much.
Nosotros este dinero que ganamos no es mucho. A veces son 30, 40 dólares al día. Todos los vendedores.
We don't make a lot of money, Medina says. Sometimes it's $30 or $40 a day. Then you've got to buy food, pay your rent, do the math. For many, a nearly $300 permit is simply out of reach.
The cost itself is a huge barrier.
Lyric Kelker is the policy director for Inclusive Action for the City. It's a nonprofit that, among some other things, advocates for street vendors in LA.
You're talking about the current cost is $291 for an annual permit. Many of these folks make less than, you know, $15,000 a year, especially in the last year when there's been this like detrimental shortage, you know. That's a significant amount of income.
There are some other barriers too, says Aureliano Santiago.
Hay vendedores que no saben ni leer. Okay? Entonces, ¿cómo van a saber?
There are vendors who don't know how to read, Santiago says. How are they supposed to know what to do? Santiago says he wants the city to head out into communities and personally hand out information. They did some of that before the pandemic began. Other vendor advocates, like Inclusive Action, want to see the permit fees reduced or abolished altogether. UCLA researchers and public counsel are releasing a report today that recommends many of those changes and more. They also want to see some major policy adjustments. Community kitchens, for example, where food vendors can prep food or clean dishes. Approval of new affordable designs for food carts. Open up underused kitchens to storage for vendors, among some other suggestions.
No queremos que nos humillen, no queremos que nos traten mal, queremos que nos den información.
We don't want to be humiliated. We don't want to be treated poorly, Santiago says. We want you, the city and the county, to give us information. For now, the city of LA has stopped giving tickets to vendors who don't have the proper city, county, and state permits. An LA City Council motion keeps this moratorium in place until the local COVID state of emergency ends and 6 months after that. But that doesn't mean vendors can't be cited for breaking the law. There are a whole host of other requirements, from where you're allowed to sell, to how clean to keep the street, to receipts for all the products you're hawking. Vendors are still vulnerable, and this tangle of red tape means they can still be ticketed, yet another cost many can't afford to pay. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, the pandemic has affected and in some cases sidelined many full-on restaurants and iconic LA foods, but the one constant is how folks remember food. The last time you ate it, the people you were with, the way the sun was beating down on you as you took a bite. Food and memory are forever coupled. For Eater LA's Mona Holmes, her childhood memories of family summer barbecues conjure up a journey throughout the city to get hot links with many delectable pit stops along the way. Mona and the rest of her colleagues over at Eater wrote about those things as part of their new series, LA's Great Barbecue Boom. She, of course, is a regular here on Greater LA, and she's with us right now. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Now, you grew up here in LA. I grew up in the South where barbecue is a staple. So let's talk about barbecue and all get hungry about it, right?
Let's do that.
you were here in the 70s and 80s, grew up in Altadena. Your family in the summers would either go to or host these summer gatherings. What was your favorite part I mean, was it the food indeed, like the barbecue or the games?
It was a lot. There was a lot to love. I mean, all the kids were the same ages, so there was always someone to hang out with and play with and get along with. The music was perfect. My dad had this entire wall dedicated to albums, you know, with his hi-fi system with a tape deck and a record player and massive speakers. But the food, I mean, ribs, potato salad, baked beans, hot links, they were so spicy and awesome, and we would just be full and happy at the end. It was perfect.
Where would your parents go and get this food? Because you're talking about the barbecue. You go to the grocery store and the hot links. Your dad got the hot links, right?
He did.
Where did he go? Where did he get them?
He would venture either solo or with all of my sisters or just one of us to pick them up in South LA at all these little stops from these. One of them was like this shiny door that you would just go to that sometimes would be open or not. That was Pete's Gourmet Sausages. That's no longer in business, but was for 72 years. But my dad would be gone for hours, and I never really knew the details of the task until he threw me in the car one day to go with him. And so we would go and pick up these links. And we'd also make these little stops around town to barbecue joints and get something to eat. And it was great because by the time we got there, we were starving. And so we just got something to nibble on until we made it back home to Altadena.
One place that is still open now, Mona, and selling hot links is a place called Mama's Chicken. Did you go there with your dad?
We did. I was so young when riding around with him. You know, I didn't remember it until working on this story. You know, my
Seriously?
Dad passed away. Yeah. I forgot about it. You know, I mean, when you're seven and you're in the car with your dad, you're just chilling with your dad.
Right.
And I didn't think about these places until later. And so I enlisted the help of other people to help me reconstruct where I went. And so I went into Mama's recently, and the second that I walked in there, I knew that was the place. It just completely sent a chill up my spine. I walked to the back just like my dad did. I picked up a box, you know, they sell them in 2 and 5 pound boxes, and threw them on the grill when I got home, and they were delicious. And that was absolutely one of my pop stops, I'm calling them, that we made many, many years ago.
Pop stops. I love it. Your story is part of a package of stories on Ader about barbecue in L.A. I'm looking at this new boom about barbecue here, but the tradition has deep roots, right, in Southern California. I mentioned the South, but there's a lot of barbecue here in SoCal as well.
Oh, my God. It's really deeply entrenched in our culture. I love our package. My colleagues and I, we've worked our tails off over the last 4 months to get these out. And one of my colleagues, Farley Elliott, wrote this incredible explainer. I hope you all check it out. About the whole tradition of Southern California barbecue. Sure, there's some places that absolutely ring true with Southern style, but we've also got Korean, Thai, Vietnamese, Filipino, and of course, vaquero and Mexican culture that is absolutely, you know, you see it constantly and maybe don't necessarily notice it. But, you know, we have absolutely wonderful barbecue here, and no one really knows how to put their finger on it. But that's the whole reason why we put this package together, to help people get a really strong understanding of these things that are right underneath our noses here. And they're all so incredibly good. So that's what makes Los Angeles a very unique barbecue town. And it's worth jumping into any time of year, really.
Well, it's not just the food, right? But it's how you make the food. Talk a little bit about barrel pits.
Yeah, everyone's seen them on street corners. I mean, you know them. They look like oil barrels, right? And they are converted into barbecue pits by these metal fabricators throughout Los Angeles. And when I looked into it, there's three prominent ones that have done it for decades, like at least 30 years. There's J&G Ornamental Iron and Barbecue Pit Factory that opened in 1988. There's another one on West Boulevard in Hyde Park called Pit City Pits. And one by a man named Sweet Daddy Rose, who unfortunately passed away this year. And these are all the three main makers who have been building them for locals for a long time. And it's a hell of a story because, you know, I mean, who would have thought that this was such a booming business? But it is, especially for Los Angeles. And the owner of J&G Ironworks says people come as far as Nevada or Palmdale to buy them because they just can't find anything like them where they are.
Oh, God, Mona, I'm so hungry right now for some barbecue. Mona Holmes, reporter with Ader LA. Her essay, by the way, titled Growing Up, on LA's Black Barbecue is up now. Check it out. Mona, as always, thanks.
Thanks for having me, Steve. The temperature's about 88. Hop in the water plug, just for old time's sake. Break to your crib, change your clothes once more, because you're invited to a barbecue to start at 4. Sitting with your friends as y'all reminisce about the days growing up and the first person you kiss. And as I think back, makes me wonder how the smell from a grill can spark up nostalgia.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, hospitals are really feeling the latest surge in COVID-19 cases. And now here in California, healthcare workers have until the end of September to get fully vaccinated. The state order applies to anyone at hospitals, nursing facilities, clinics, doctor's offices, even dialysis centers and substance abuse treatment programs. And many other states plan to implement similar measures too. Here to talk about how it's all going to play out in L.A. are a couple of healthcare workers. Gabriel Montoya, an emergency room tech over at Kaiser Permanente in Downey and a member of the United Healthcare Workers Union. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Brad Spellberg is a chief medical officer over at L.A. County USC Medical Center. Dr. Spellberg, nice to have you back.
Thanks so much.
And Brad, I'm going to start with you. At your hospital right now, are you seeing a surge in patients? What's going on over there?
We're definitely seeing more COVIDs than we were seeing, you know, 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, substantially more, I would say. The good news is that most of the cases that we're seeing are relatively mild. But as the volumes go up, even when we have mostly mild cases, that means we still are seeing some severe cases ending up in the ICU.
What percent of employees over at County USC are currently vaccinated? Do you have that number?
Yeah, 73% of our employees are vaccinated, and that's the same, about the same number as across the Department of Health Services for LA County.
So with this state mandate coming in by the end of next month, how are you going to verify and monitor vaccination status? You're obviously doing that now. Will you continue to do that? And are you, people who aren't vaccinated, are you going to regularly test them, tell them to go home? What happens?
The county supervisors have taken the ball and run with it. And so yesterday, the board passed an executive order that all county employees must now be vaccinated. And only exemptions for medical or religious reasons would we then do testing for. So I think we're now in a position where the big impetus is just getting everybody vaccinated.
Gabriel, what about you? You're in the ER in Downey at Kaiser. How are things going over there right now? Have you seen a big surge?
Yeah, we've definitely seen an increase from what we were looking at just a couple of months ago, just like at County USC. You know, we got a little lull. We got this nice little vacation, so to speak. And now we're seeing the numbers climb back up every day. And we're also seeing the patient load continue to grow. So our waiting room times have gone up in the ER. Although I would agree with the doctor that, you know, our ICU patients, there's not as many and they're less critical. However, we still see that our resources are being strained in the ER at Kaiser Downey.
So tell me, do we know how many people you have in the hospital right now are unvaccinated or vaccinated? Are those numbers being, and I'm talking about patients, not employees.
For at Kaiser Downey, the numbers are above. So really about 90% are above of the patients that are being hospitalized at our hospital are unvaccinated. And so, you know, we're getting vaccinated patients that come in with COVID also. However, their symptoms are mild. We can send them to, you know, really what we call like a fast track area where we can basically have the doctor examine them. They may get a prescription, go home. You know, those are really how the vaccinated patients seem to be symptomatic in that sort of really mild way. But our unvaccinated patients are the majority of those that are being hospitalized. I believe the last numbers, 95% of those in our ICU are unvaccinated. And I think it was 93% of those hospitalized outside of the ICU were unvaccinated.
Mm. Are you vaccinated?
Yeah, I actually got vaccinated the first week that Kaiser put it out there for our healthcare workers. So I was vaccinated. My last shot was on January 6th.
January 6th. So you've had a lot of months. What percentage of the people in the emergency department are? Do you know?
So, you know, it's less than 50%. So we do not have a majority of the workforce in the ER vaccinated.
What reasons are you hearing among those who haven't gotten their shots?
I mean, honestly, we're not insulated from the reasons from the outside, unfortunately. You know, it has to do with where people sit on the political spectrum. You know, there are, you know, healthcare workers are not insulated from the misinformation that is floating around on the internet, news networks. You know, they're not insulated from those things. And then, of course, there's people that are generally concerned about a new vaccine. Often what I hear from my coworkers is, I don't know what the long-term care, you know, long-term issues are going to be. Is this going to change, you know, my, you know, cellular structure as I get older? And then, you know, from my coworkers, you know, that are still at an age where they can get pregnant, you know, they're concerned about what does that do for fertility. And so there's still a lot of this misinformation and lack of information floating around. And I'm going to be quite frank, I don't think that a lot of employers put in the amount of effort that we would have liked to have seen from labor side point of view in educating our membership. So we have this mandate coming up, and our question as labor leaders is, where was this education that we feel should have been more aggressive in getting people more educated on and combating this misinformation that seems to be going around?
Brad, same question to you, Dr. Spellberg. What reasons are you hearing over at County USC? Your numbers are a little higher among staff members, right?
Yeah, well, I did want to go back to the other question really quickly, which is that across the Department of Health Services, 95% of the COVID patients in the hospital have not been vaccinated. I'm also the interim CMO at Olive View Medical Center, and so I'm reviewing all COVID admissions to both hospitals. And if you look at people who were admitted because of COVID, remember the 95% number includes anybody who had a positive test, but we're testing all admissions. If you come in with a car accident, you have no COVID symptoms, we're still testing you. If you look at the number of people who have COVID in the hospital who are hospitalized because of COVID, that number is 98%. So this is a disease of the unvaccinated at this point. I think that Gabriel did a really nice job of describing the fact that people who work in health campuses are subject to the same misinformation, disinformation, and questions and concerns that everyone else in the public is. And we have been very aggressive at trying to address these concerns. They're discussed every week on a town hall, there's outreach, et cetera. There is going to be a component of the population that just isn't ever going to want to be vaccinated. And if you are a healthcare provider, if you are a healthcare worker, if you're coming in contact with patients, there is an ethical responsibility to protect those patients from this disease, this contagious disease, and protect our staff and coworkers.
What do you think will be the end result? I'll ask both of you, but I'll start with you, Brad. What will be the end result of this? Do you think more people will get vaccinated, or do you think people will quit and just be like, I don't want to deal with any of this?
Well, you know, I'm going to reiterate that just as for Gabriel, I got vaccinated the instant I was able to, and most of our staff did as well, the large majority. And so the reality is most of our staff want this. They want to be protected. You know, does that mean there will be nobody who's upset? No. But I think our expectation is that the order from the state and the executive order from the board is going to result in essentially close to 100% of our staff being vaccinated, except for the very legitimate medical or religious exemptions.
Gabriel, over there at Kaiser.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're going to see the same thing. We're going to have, you know, people who really have those genuine exemptions and issues are going to not get vaccinated, and people that don't will definitely get vaccinated. I mean, we've heard threats from, you know, coworkers and union members that they will sooner quit their job before they get a vaccination. But I think the reality will hit people in September that people have, you know, bills to pay, mortgages to pay, children to support, and people are going to, you know, reconsider that. And I think that one of the things that people need to remember also, right, is that we're still a workplace. You know, there is kind of this
peer pressure, if you will, for people asking non-vaccinated coworkers, like, look, you need to get vaccinated because you're not only putting patients at risk, you're putting us at risk.
So much to take into account. Gabriel Montoya, emergency room tech over at Kaiser Permanente in Downey, member of the United Healthcare Workers Union. Dr. Brad Spellberg, chief medical officer over at LA County USC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, some of your questions answered about wildfires, preventing them, fighting them, fleeing and surviving them, getting insured for them. An update to our reporting on wildfires in Southern California tomorrow on GLA. Ask any question of us. Subscribe to the podcast too. Get your frequent tour of Greater LA and the issues affecting it. Our website is kcrw.com/greaterLA. Again, kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl were all instrumental on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis, thanking you for your ears this evening. Have a great night.